Jeffrey Toobin is with us here on The Paula Gordon Show. A great pleasure. I went back to one of your two current employers, not CNN, where you go next, but to The New Yorker. And I think the very first thing that I found in my wonderfully archived New Yorkers, which is a fabulous resource, was what I think was your first contribution in 1993. I could be wrong, but it was way early. And you were saying that it was you said outrageous. It wasn't just bad, it was outrageous that President Bush, George the First, George H.W., had given parole, had said it was okay that the last of the Iran-Contra people would not go to court.
That's very good research. I think that was the first thing I ever
wrote
for The New Yorker.
Wow. And while it was good reporting and it was well balanced and it did reflect your time working with the special prosecutor on the Iran-Contra, it was very clear that you didn't think it was right to stop the democratic process, to stop the lawyering of which you are certainly one, mm-hmm. and just say, oh, it's okay, we're not going to talk about Iran-Contra. And in fact, there have been tremendous repercussions over the last 20 years that we didn't stop Reagan and say to Reagan and all of the people around it and that Oliver, that we didn't pay attention.
We didn't pay enough attention. But I mean, the issue of the conflict over separation of powers, you know, that historically, I think what Iran-Contra is a story about the president trying to expand his powers at the expense of Congress. And Dick Cheney, who was on the Iran-Contra committee, wrote a dissenting report that he himself has cited as a blueprint for what this current administration has tried to do. And if you look at the Guantanamo cases, there's going to be a new one up this year as well. I mean, these controversies are fresh. And one thing the court has done over the past 4 years is cut back on the president's power in this one area. But Anthony Kennedy, who was usually sided with the conservatives, has always sided with the liberals, at least so far, on these Guantanamo cases about the Geneva Convention, about presidential powers. We'll see with the new justices who wins those cases. But, you know, as you point out, these are fresh controversies.
They keep keeping history fresh. That was, I guess, my only point.
You wrote about in a full book, and in this this book referenced the what was styled Bush versus Gore as being maybe not the lowest moment of the Supreme Court, but one of the lower ebbs of the Supreme Court. And I'm interested in you, since you are a scholar of that institution, a juxtaposition of that as a less than noble moment in the history of the court, and what you would construe as the other side of that. What is one of the really fine moments in the history of the court, particularly in recent history?
Well, I think Bush v. Gore was a bad decision, and the nine is not, you know, thumbs up, thumbs down on every decision.
Right.
I mean, it's mostly descriptive, it's mostly analytical, but I couldn't help myself when it came to Bush v. Gore.
Because you'd written a whole book about
right,
it.
Yeah. Well, and also because, you know, I think one thing justices owe us is ideological consistency. You know, if you're going to be in favor of states' rights, if you're going to be against an expansive reading of the Equal Protection Clause, you have to do it in a case where a Republican's ox is gored as well, and I don't think the majority did it. I think one decision that reflected how the court has changed and how society has changed is Lawrence v. Texas. It's Justice Kennedy's opinion saying that the state of Texas cannot criminalize consensual sodomy between men, and basically says you can't make people criminals for who they are. And I think that was an example of the living Constitution at its best. Clearly, in the 18th century, there would have been no doubt that that sort of behavior could have been criminalized. But society has changed, and the Supreme Court has changed, and the institution has changed. And one of the things I write about is how in 1986, when Bowers v. Hartwick was decided, which upheld that kind of prosecution, you know, gay law clerks were still mostly in the closet. By 2003, you know, there were gay law clerks out in the open, and this, you know, the justices are sheltered, but this was something that they're not sheltered from. And I think it was hard for at least some of them to say, you know, I can't look at these people every day and think that they're criminals.
That's an important point, because you also talk about the cynicism that can easily develop by people who spend all day every day in Washington, whether they're a Supreme Court justice or a senator or a congressman or a staffer or you know a lobbyist, whatever. And that cynicism, I mean, these are people. The importance of that personal interaction, just the life experience that goes on all day, every day, having gay clerks change their perspective.
And that leads to sort of the least cynical justice on the court, who I think is David Souter, you know, who leads this monastic existence, mm-hmm. the only bachelor justice. He'd never heard of Diet Coke when he arrived. He'd never heard of the Supremes. He doesn't like electric light. He moves his chair around his chambers to catch the light over the course of the day. And it was Souter who was so devastated by Bush v. Gore, because he has this idealistic notion of the court. And sure, people can disagree, but he thought that was such a cynical maneuver that he actually thought about resigning the court. So, you know, some people are more cynical than others, and Souter is...
Well, I raise that because it seems that that's one of the challenges, particularly as, you know, the professionalization you referred to earlier, the fact that these are all now have all been trial judges or judges, which was as I think you said, has never been the case before.
First time in history. Yeah.
That is a much more constrained perspective on the world than has historically been the case. You do that in an environment that also is Washington, which is sort of a hothouse in itself. Pile on a dose of cynicism, and it seems that the institution itself is under some threat just by virtue of the narrowing of focus, particularly if you add in these now political influences that are just laser-like in trying to enforce perspectives. And you know, that's a problem. That's really the question. Is there a way around this? Can we find ways of ventilating the space?
You know what? I don't
move
think
them to
so.
Kansas or
I,
something?
I don't think so. I think that's sort of as it should be. I think the court is a political institution. It's insulated in some ways, but it can't be insulated in every way. You know, Stephen Breyer is the only justice who always goes to the State of the Union address, and he says he does it for a reason. He says, "Look, we are part of the government. We can't pretend that we're not." And the justices don't like going. It's awkward about whether to applaud or not. They just feel out of place. But Breyer says, no, we are a part, and we need to show people we're a part.
And that's part of the struggle that's going on now, just in terms of what is that appropriate balance. We talk about the balance of these three very importantly different branches of our federal government, but that is always in tension, isn't it?
Always. But the issue is, how political is that controversy? The tension is inevitable. Is it also political tension? And I think the answer is absolutely yes.
Absolutely yes. Let's go away and come back in just a moment for a final couple of minutes with Jeffrey Toobin. Be with us.